Hello, friends. Welcome back to the Forrest Stevens Show. This episode's going to be a little bit different. Usually I get into some kind of crazy new thought that I've had, or interview somebody interesting, or explore some previous idea that I've had in depth so that I can improve myself, my brain, my well-being, and encourage you to do the same. In this episode, it's still about encouraging growth, but you've read the title. This is How to Invest for Beginners. This might be a little mini series within this show. I'm going to try to explore as many concepts as possible within this episode, and it might jump around a little bit because I don't have a script. So I'll just kind of get into it and talk first, actually, about why I wanted to do this episode. I'm 29 years old. I have a lot of friends my age, even younger, who don't know anything about investing. And when you don't know anything, it's very hard to learn anything. Somebody tells you, oh, just invest in an index fund or the S&P 500 ETF. People are like, what the fuck's an index fund? What is an ETF? You know, it's like WTF is an ETF, right? These are things that if you're at all interested in self-investing, or even if you've talked to a financial advisor, these are terms that you're basically going to pick up pretty quickly. So I'm going to explore those a little bit. So an ETF, electronically traded fund, and these are created by different companies, investment firms, and the ETFs are usually either like a sector, so it's like the consumer staples ETF, there's a oil ETF or energy ETF, there's a basket of stocks within an ETF, basically. And they're not always sector dependent. There's different ideas, like there's an inverse Jim Cramer ETF. Those three words at the beginning before the ETF, now that I've explained that, you should know that. But inverse means basically the opposite of. Jim Cramer is just a CNBC analyst who has a show called Mad Money, who makes a lot of bad calls. And so somebody's created a ETF that does the opposite of what he does. So ETFs are plentiful. There's so many different options out there. And what most people say to, like, as advice for beginners, they say just invest in the S&P 500 ETF and hold it for 10 years. You'll get an average return of around 10%. That's what people say. And they're not exactly wrong by saying that, but they're going off of previous price and previous returns. And another thing that a lot of financial people will say is, past history is not indicative of future returns. So, or past performance, I should say. Past history, that's the same thing. Those are the two words that mean the same thing in that. So past performance is not indicative of future earnings or future performance or future returns. If you invest at the wrong time in the S&P 500 and you wait 10 years, your returns are not 8% or 10%. They could be lower, much lower. There's basically your returns will be something, but 10 years is a long time. So that kind of brings me to this other idea. I bring up the ETF so that you can understand what those are, and we'll get back into that. But something I just said there sparked another idea in my head a little bit about something that's very important. When you're investing, you have to decide what your investment horizon is. That's one of the most important things. Because if you start watching YouTube videos, if you start reading articles and they say, oh, these stocks are winners, this is a good ETF, this is what I do, why does that person do that? Why does that person think that those are good picks? And the most important thing out of there is, what is that person's time horizon? That's the most important thing. And how you figure out your time horizon is basically you look at the savings that you have, your ability to invest that savings, and for how long you think you'll be able to. So I don't think that anybody recommends investing 100% of your savings. I think that most people would figure out basically an amount that you think that you could lose and an amount that you would be okay with basically not having for an extended period of time. So it doesn't necessarily have to be something that you'd be okay losing. That's it. Something I just said there, but I want to retract that a little bit. There are like basically the S&P 500 index, and I didn't explain what that is, but that's the top 500 companies in corporate America. Basically, you're investing in corporate America, and it's weighted. So larger companies have, or well, there's an equal weighted, but typically when we talk S&P 500 ETF, people are talking about the weighted index. So Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, Google, Nvidia. These are all top six companies, top seven companies or whatever in there, you know, Meta, Tesla, plenty others, Broadcom. You can just Google the holdings of the S&P 500 and you'll see. And so those are weighted out, in there. Basically, your percentage of losing any money goes down the longer you hold that. It's always still possible. But the likelihood, or basically the gamble that you're taking, becomes more and more in your favor the longer you are able to hold an asset. Now, that doesn't guarantee that you're coming out positive, but if you play the odds, which all investing is a degree of playing the odds, then you will basically come out successful the majority of the time. So broadly, there's two different types of investing, and kind of a third one as well that is kind of a variation on one of the other two types. So the main two, I would say, is speculative and debt-based investing. So I've been talking about the S&P 500. I would actually put that in the speculative category because you are speculating that in the future, that will continue to be a good place to have your money, and that the returns of these companies are high, and then people will value those companies even higher. Now, an index is interesting to invest in because they basically, if a company gets bigger, they increase that position size within that index, and if a company gets smaller, they reduce that position size. So that's almost like a strategy to invest in the winners. By investing in the equal weight index. And that performs so well because of that strategy. And it takes away a little bit of the speculative nature of investing in companies for their future returns. Now we can go to a more even speculative type of investment. These are companies that basically you think in the future will have something drastically change in their value. So a tech company that says it's going to do something but hasn't yet, says it's going to make money but hasn't yet, and is burning cash and making debt. Once they prove that they can do that, they will be much more valuable than they are when they can't prove that. Same goes for assets like cryptocurrency. Basically, you're betting that it is going to become more scarce, more usable, more accepted, and more held by individuals. And you are speculating into the future that that is going to happen. Like commodities, precious metals, these kind of things. You're also speculating or hoping or guessing, or you know, you have some evidence to suggest that in the future that there'll be more demand and less supply, because that is what dictates the price of something, supply and demand in a marketplace. And basically the stock market is a marketplace. That's why they call it the stock market. And so that's the only thing you need to really think about is supply and demand when speculating on something. If there's more demand as well for a company's product or service, then they get to make more money. And then because they make more money, they will become more valuable to speculators. A lot of investors won't like me calling investing in stocks speculation, but it basically is. Now, the other type of investing is debt instruments. So these same companies I'm talking about, they raise money in all sorts of ways, and one of those ways is by issuing something called a bond. And what that bond is it's in the bond market. You could purchase it, and you would hold that debt, and they would pay you a fixed percentage on that debt you that you hold. So keep it simple here. You buy a $100 bond from Apple, from Google, or from the government. The government also issues bonds. When we think of the US government being $34 trillion in debt, who are they indebted to? They're indebted to people that hold their debt. And you are able to hold their debt because they issue treasury bonds. T-bills, people call them. Now, these are kind of a guaranteed way to make money if you hold them to maturity. So bonds have them like a length that they exist, basically. And at the end of that length, you receive your principal back. You receive the money back. And then throughout that time of holding, you're receiving that agreed upon percentage. So with bonds, you could make 5%, right? So, and that bond could either be 3 months, 1 year, 2 years, 10 years, 20 years, and you're making that percentage the entire time, and you get back the principal at the end. Now, there's ways to invest in basically the bond market through ETFs, depending on what kind of bonds you want to buy, what kind of debt instruments you want to buy. But there's also the bond market. So this is a secondary market for bonds, and basically what that means is you could. This is more complicated for the individual, but you can do it through banks pretty easily. There are ways of doing it, and you could buy bonds through that. And then the thing about that is that that's a marketplace, right? So supply and demand comes into place. And basically, if you have a bond that is paying you very low percentage rates, and you've paid full value for it, and the percentage rates of the bonds around it start going up, and the new issuance of bonds, the percentage rate is higher, then that bond actually be that you hold actually becomes worth less if you try to resell it in that secondary bond market. If you still hold it to maturity, you still get that capital back, and you've kept that percentage going for as long as you've held it. So there's a bit of a play in there depending on what the interest rates are. And if you do get interested in investing, that's all you're going to hear about is don't fight the Fed. What is the federal interest rate? Oh, they've paused. They've done a rate hike. They've done a cut, a rate cut. And it's I couldn't even think of that because they haven't done it in so long. And right now, and so that's the other thing you kind of need to understand a little bit before investing is what is the investing environment like right now? What is a good deal? What is the market, right? Because when you talk to somebody that doesn't know about investing, they'll tell you probably a story about somebody they know, or basically those stories exist in the ethos where people have invested, bought 100 shares of Google or what, a million, like, I don't know, lots of shares of Google pre-2000, and they still hold them and they're worth a ton. And it's like, wow, if only I did that 20 years ago. And it's like that same moment is happening right now. So it's like, wow, I wish that I had just bought this because look at how much it's worth in 20 years. So that's kind of the idea that I believe in, that there's always opportunities no matter what the market is. It's just, what are the opportunities? And that is kind of the mind of a stock picker, but it's just also the mind of somebody who's slightly educated on the investing environment. You're going to buy, well, you should want to buy things that have the highest potential of going up and the lowest risk going down in a ratio compared to other ones. So there might be a high ratio that it goes down, but there's also a high ratio that it goes up, and those two work on each other and you allocate. So that's the other thing you should really think about. I've talked about how much to invest from your savings and to really understand that number for yourself, but how much do you allocate on a specific asset, and how do you diversify within those assets? That's another thing that beginner investors have heard but don't understand, is diversification. This is the idea of spreading your money out in different fields so that you're not just invested in oil companies and then the price of a barrel of oil goes way down and their profits go way down and your entire investment is down. So the idea is to spread it out to certain different key diversifications, depending on your risk tolerance or how much you want to make a bet in the way the world wants to be, or in the way the world will become in your eyes, or hope to become. So because the thing about diversification is it's going to help you have some winners to offset the some losers, and in total you hope to have more winners than losers, and that's just a dollar figure. So because the world is so global, that's another reason that people just say, hey, if you don't know what to do, just buy the S&P 500 index, hold it for 10 years. There's 500 companies within there. Yes, they're all part of corporate America, and that might seem like, oh, that's not very diverse, but a lot of them have different access and different relationships and different ways of getting money and selling different services and all that, right? It's very diversified with what they do. And then they're also their connections and their commerce around the world. So it's pretty diversified. Like, you don't necessarily have to be like, oh, I need to invest in international companies or like on top of the S&P 500. People definitely can. And this is all just like on your discretion, right? There's no right way to invest. There's only ways that have proven to be right in the past. And based on that, based on that information alone, and just speculation into the future. And there's this thing where people that don't know how to invest, they just say, well, when I get into that, I'll just get a financial advisor who does it for me. And the thing about that is they take a percentage. And the thing about that is that's okay, but it could be a little more optimal. So it depends if you want to pay somebody to do it, or if you want to just learn some very simple things so that you can basically do it yourself. Now, am I saying you're going to be as sophisticated as a financial investor? No, but that doesn't mean that you couldn't still make the exact same returns as them, because sometimes there's this kind of thing that happens where additional information doesn't actually help you, right? There's like a diminishing returns that kind of happens with information. And there's a way higher risk of you making mistakes because you have limited information, but there's also a risk that people will make mistakes because they have too much information. So for the vast majority of people, I think it probably would be a very good idea to just go with a financial advisor and just basically learn the terminology of saying, like, I want to be diversified, I want to have low risk, I want to Or maybe even say like, oh, I want something like a 60-40 portfolio, and that would be 60% stocks, 40% bonds. And that's been that's a typical arrangement that has proven in the history to be stable, not to make the best returns ever. It's not going to beat Warren Buffett year over year, but it will be good enough. Or you could invest with Warren Buffett by just buying Berkshire Hathaway stock, right? Huge percentage of his portfolio is Apple. So you've invested, it's not going to be as diversified as the S&P 500, but there's a lot of private companies in there. There's Geico, which is an insurance company. They own some candy company. They own 25% of Kraft Heinz. They own some oil stocks in Occidental Petroleum. They own some financials with a large stake in Bank of America. So it's like they're pretty diversified within that alone, and you'd be investing in what people claim to be the greatest investor in the world. So it's kind of funny that you're like, well, I'm going to invest with this guy who like just works at Fidelity or whatever, and you think that's better than investing in the greatest investor in the world? I don't know. I'm also not just saying like just buy Berkshire Hathaway. I'm just saying that's an option. And when you begin to understand this kind of stuff a little bit more, you can see why you might not necessarily need a financial advisor, especially if you just do something very simple. Now, if you take that advice and you say, oh yeah, okay, I don't need a financial advisor, and I'm just going to pick a bunch of stocks that I think are good. If you don't read what their debt is, if you don't understand the investing environment, if you don't understand their possible futures, their possible pitfalls, their competition, if you get unlucky that, you know, institutions start dumping them, if they make a choice to cut back a dividend or to issue more shares or to something like this, right? It's like, you are going to make a lot of mistakes if you just go out and start investing in individual stocks right away. You're going to learn the hard way. So if you're going to do that or get a financial advisor and go with them with some funds, do that. Pick the financial advisor. Do not go out and pick a bunch of random stocks that you think are cool. If you do it with a little tiny bit of money on an app or a brokerage that doesn't charge you, and just have fun with it and use it as a learning process and be like, basically, I'm willing to lose $100 a month on this as if I'm paying somebody $100 to learn this per month, but I'm just learning it myself. So I talked about interest rates and that we are currently, as of, you know, whatever the month it is now, November 2023, we are in a high interest rate environment. Now, we've been in higher interest rates environments, but every environment, every economical environment that we have is not dictated alone by the interest rate. It's also employment, the currency's actual value, the world around, and just like your own financial situation as well, and your own educational situation, and you know, how at threat your income is. And there's a lot of uncertainty. There's always a huge amount of uncertainty. So with uncertainty comes fear, and with fear comes decision-making that can be clouded by that fear. You know, you could think that like, well, everybody's obsessed with green energy, so I'm going to invest in solar. I'm going to invest in companies that go and put solar on people's roofs. But if you don't understand interest rates, you don't understand the environment of higher interest rates, you won't understand that that's how people put solar on their roof, is by taking out a loan to do so. And by having a higher percentage of interest rate on that loan, they are less able to do that because it costs them more to do that, because it's all borrowed money, it's all leveraged. So with higher interest rates, you have to look at leveraged assets a little bit differently. You have to look at banks, because they have a huge amount of leverage. You should look at companies that hold a bunch of real estate and make their money through investing in real estate. There's things called REITs, which is a real estate investment trust, a REIT. And so basically that's a company that by becoming a REIT, it's basically putting into law that they have to return a certain amount of money that they earn through real estate back to their shareholders of that REIT. So it's basically you can like partially own property and make money from the rent of that property. So it's a way to get into real estate when buying a house or buying some sort of real estate asset is unfeasible for yourself. Interest rates dictate a lot. They don't dictate everything. Like I said, there's kind of the greater environment around it. So begin to understand your environment. And I will get on to now investing strategies that people have. Now, once again, I'm going back to that benchmark, the S&P 500. Basically, that's an investment strategy within that index that runs automatically. So it's kind of brainless. It's basically like an algorithm that they have. So it's market cap weighted. So what that means is when a company's market cap or total value of that company goes up, the index acquires more of it. So they basically keep investing in their winners and they invest out of their losers. Now that just thinking about that at face value, oh, that sounds good. Invest in the winners. That's great. And it is a winning strategy. It has worked throughout history. Another way that people invest is literally the complete opposite. And it can also work. Now, that's what's very interesting is that, but that requires a little bit more picking on your own. So that strategy is called value investing. So basically, it's looking at companies where the stock price has actually gone way down, their market capitalization has gone down, and figuring out why that's happened, and figuring out and believing in that company or that sector. Even you could do this ETF as well through sectors, so you could diversify some of your risk but still be in a specific sector that has become distressed. Like I said, you know, there's been a lot of assets that have become their price has changed because of the higher interest rates, so prices changed because of environmental reasons, investing environment reasons. And so basically, you could pick out, like, you could say, okay, I think consumer staples are very undervalued for what they will be in the future. Like, everybody's going to still need them in the future. They're going to actually appreciate. That could just be a thesis you have, right? An idea that you have. And you could buy something because it's undervalued and with the hopes that it goes up. And sometimes that can work and sometimes it can't. Another investing strategy, and this is on top of figuring out what you're investing in, but this investing strategy is called dollar cost averaging. It's called DCA. What that means is basically taking some of the thought out of it and having a reoccurring buy and a reoccurring investment of capital into your investment account. A reoccurring buy, monthly, weekly, daily, whatever it is. You could automate it or you could do it yourself. Now, if you do it yourself, you're going to risk not doing it. If you have it automatic, then it's kind of like an index fund in the way where it's brainless, it's automatic, it just kind of market cap weights itself. So dollar cost averaging just automatically invests into the asset that you think is going up. There's another strategy as far as buying and selling stocks, which goes like buying the dip. Now this works in what's called a bull run. A bull run means that sector of stocks or stocks at large basically are increasing in value. They're constantly going up, even if they have dips down, but following a trend line of the last average of 200 days. So that's a 200 days moving average. Using that as a indicator that shows you basically that your asset is ascending in a bull run. Now, the opposite of that is a bear run or a bear market, and that is when it's going down in that same fashion. And pulling the average down as well. So the average kind of follows because it's the average of all the last 200 days. That's one indicator. There's also the 50-day moving average, 9-day moving average, whatever you want. You know, you could use whatever indicators you want to be able to dictate price action of a stock. Let's see. So buying the dip would mean thinking or understanding that we're in a bull market, and then in a bull market things still go down to some degree, but then they start going up, and on average they go higher over the long term, and you're actually on that down streak. You're waiting for either some kind of confirmation or just some level that you think is right for a pullback, and you're buying at that lower price. So you're buying in the dip of the mountains, so in the valley of the hills that are a chart. So that would be another strategy. Now that works a lot better on indexes than it does on individual stocks, because individual stocks could have some sort of fundamental problem within the company. And then you're buying on the dip, but then it keeps dipping down lower. And it's also like trends can reverse. So you could be in a bull market buying those dips. The trend could reverse and start going into a bear market. And you could be losing all of those gains and even going beyond that. Because when you buy in a dip, if you're buying in a dip and you're dollar cost averaging, or you're reinvesting throughout that dip buying process, you can lower your cost basis over and over and over. And you can also, through dollar cost averaging, the idea is basically you could also lower your cost your cost basis. And your cost basis is how much it costs you to buy that asset. Another thing that's worth understanding is dividends and earnings. So earnings are something that's reported usually quarterly for companies. And basically they tell you, the two big metrics are earning per share. The other one is quarterly revenue. So with that, you can see if a company exceeded their estimates. Earnings per share are dictated. So like if the shares for a company, there's like 100 shares, or I mean, it's never as low as 100. It's 100,000 more plus millions of shares. And if there's if they issue more shares, which companies can do, or they've earned less, then earnings per share can go down. If they've bought back shares, or their price or their revenue has gone up, they could beat expectations on earnings per share and revenue as well. So they're both closely tied. They're basically measuring the same thing. Did this company make more money for the share that you're holding? Or did it just make more money in general or less money? Now, these are significant because there'll be a lot of price movement around these things. If you're investing for the long term, their earnings will just look like little kind of blips up or down. They won't be that significant, but they also can dictate the direction or a change of direction of where a company is going. The other thing I mentioned there was dividends. Now, dividends are very interesting because basically, this is an agreement that the company could change. They're not obligated to do this, but a lot of companies do this, which is they issue dividends, which means they pay, if you hold a share, they'll pay you a certain amount every month, every quarter, once a year, whatever they've decided on. And it can be random, they can do special dividends, they can just return basically the cash that they've made from operating their business to the shareholders. Now, a lot of people, especially in Canada, where I'm from, are obsessed with dividends. But all dividends is taking money out of their business and giving it to you. Now, if a company is worth $100 million and they take out $1 million and give that to somebody, that company's worth $99 million. They, by paying dividends, I mean, they're taking money out of their business. So it's not something that needs to happen for you to actually get money out of owning a stock. There's a big kind of like misconception because of the simplicity of being like, hey, I get 5% back through dividends by owning this company, and they're paying me to own it. And it feels like a bond that you're getting paid interest on. It feels like a REIT that you're getting the money from the rent. But you're kind of limiting the ability of that company to grow, because money is fuel for companies to grow. And sometimes companies are better off paying dividends because they cannot grow as quickly as you could grow your money elsewhere. So they're kind of more like a bond in that way, where they're just kind of a little more stable of a company. They don't have crazy fluctuations. And these are older established companies a lot of the times that pay a consistent dividend, that are good for that style of investing, if that's what you want. And I've fallen into that trap at the beginning of my investing career, which is why I wanted to talk to you about it, of thinking that, oh, I want to invest in dividend earning companies because I want to get some kind of cash flow going. And there can be a big temptation of that. Now, what dividends does for the simpler investor is it basically makes you have to sell part of that company periodically. Like, it's lowering the actual intrinsic value of that company every single time they pay out a dividend, and hopefully they'll, you know, increase their revenues, becoming a bigger business anyway, even though they pay that dividend. And so over time you still see a price increase in that company. But that price could have increased even quicker if it hadn't paid that dividend. So for me, I do a little bit of a mix. I do invest in some dividend things, but I will also completely invest in companies that don't pay dividends. And I will use that in a tax advantaged way, because in Canada, you have a TFSA. And if you hold American companies that pay dividends, you automatically pay a 15% withholding tax on those dividends. Now, if you hold American companies that don't pay dividends, but the value of the shares have increased and you sell them, you don't have to pay American capital gains tax for that. And you don't have to pay Canadian capital gains tax either, because you're in a TFSA. You've already paid taxes on that money when you invested it into the investment account. And there's a certain limit of what you can do as well. So that's another thing. Like, there's so much to understand with investing. Like, you know, I'm like 30 minutes in or whatever, but there's a lot to talk about. And I could get into taxes. I can get into... So I should have answered this one earlier. But what is the reason to invest in something when you could just keep your money in your savings account? And especially right now, you know, you could earn 3, 4, maybe even 5% just on having your money in a savings account. Now, that's great. I just get paid for having my money there and I don't have to do anything. And like that's fine. Now, the reason they're paying that is because they can take your money, and they do. They borrow it from you short term and they invest it for the long term. And on that, like even 5% that they're giving you, they're investing it in some sort of bonds, typically in a bank situation, and they're making 5.5% or 6%, and they're taking the difference and they're earning that on your money. Now, you can say, okay, well, what is 0.5% or 1% or even 2%? What do I care about that little of money? That seems like very little. Well, over a long period of time, these 1 or 2% of difference can make like hundreds of thousands of dollars, depending on the initial investment and the amount of time. But it makes huge amounts of difference, the different percentages that you earn, because it compounds. So for instance, if you lose 1% per year, and this gets me into my other topic here, which is inflation. If you lose 1% of something per year, the second year, if you calculated it off of that first year's principal, you're actually losing more than 1%. You're going to lose 1.1% or whatever it is. And it's and then the next year after that, it's even more. So it's compounding that percentage based on the original percentage. And sometimes it, you know, you could pay, you can pay things that compound monthly even, or like, you know, credit card debt, for instance. It's like, what, it's going to be 19.99%. So you're paying 20%, but then it also compounds every single month. So you're paying more if you don't pay down your principal, because your principal is actually getting larger, or if you don't pay down your interest. And it's just like, it becomes this brutal thing of like compound interest just absolutely wrecking you on the negative side of it, and also absolutely complimenting you on the positive side of it. Now, usually, and I would say almost exclusively, interest rates are raised higher because of inflation. Now, that is their combat to inflation. And inflation is basically the cost of goods and services that we use in this world go up. And the actual ability or the value of our dollar goes down in relation to the costs of goods and services. And there's a target inflation rate that the government and that Federal Reserve in the States does, or the Bank of Canada in Canada does, that there's a target inflation that they have. Now, they can't just be like, okay, inflation is fixed, inflation is this. They have to kind of do certain things. They have to either buy debt, they have to print money, they have to restrict money being added to the supply of money. And the way that they can restrict basically the flow of capital is by raising interest rates. So if a bank is going to give you a mortgage for 2%, you could buy a more expensive house. So you could spend more capital. You could increase the cost of housing by being more able, as well as everyone else being more able. So that increases the value of that asset. Now, real estate is largely dictated on what the interest rates are, because it's such a leveraged asset for the majority of people. We put 10% down. That means we're leveraging 9 times the money that we're putting in, which is crazy. And it's the other thing too is like, everybody thinks like, oh, buying a house, it's a great investment, all this. What it is it's a asset that usually goes up over time, which is great. And it's a highly leveraged. So if it actually goes up, then that amount that you've made is actually like a lot more, because you're 9 times leveraged or whatever. And that's awesome, but it's also extremely illiquid. So if you have the negative side of interest rates, if interest rates are going up for you and you are having to put more money into it and the value of your house is actually coming down, then you see the negative side of those interest rates, and the illiquidity of that asset can be a very big problem. So it's really easy to buy and sell a stock. It's pretty easy to buy and sell a bond. And it's very easy to sell an ETF as well. These are very liquid assets. It's harder to sell physical assets. It's harder to sell collectibles or precious metals or a house, right? How long is a house on a market for? Really depends on the market. Sometimes it can be very illiquid. And even if it's a hot market, you still have to do all the lawyer stuff. You have to do the inspection. There's still time. Like, even when it's fast, it's not that fast. It's not like within like a minute of logging on to your broker and selling something. So it's a sketchy investment, buying a house, actually, because of how illiquid it is. Now, in history, it's been a pretty good investment, because over time, real estate has gone up with and past inflation. So inflation is something that happens, right? Year over year, basically your dollar is losing value. Now, even when they're increasing interest rates and they're trying to lower inflation, they still want inflation to happen. They don't want to get to a point of deflation where the value of goods and services are actually going down. They want to just level it out and also increase it gradually, which is crazy to me. So holding cash, you are losing like 3% per year on average, they say, but a lot of times a lot more than that. A lot of times a lot more than that. And what did I say about interest rates compounding over a long period of time? So holding cash is not good because the value of it goes down all the time. Some a lot more than others, depending on the currency and the country and their Federal Reserve and their system of monetary policy. Now, basically, investing in bonds is basically just going to be beating inflation, probably. It also depends on when you're buying the bonds and what the rates are. But right now, it's probably just beating inflation. Savings accounts can be maybe matching inflation, maybe beating it. But if you actually look at your inflation-adjusted returns, they're going to be significantly lower than your actual returns. So when you're thinking about an investment, if you think, oh, I can make like, I could probably make like 3%, 4% from this, 5%. Okay, what's the actual return adjusted for inflation? What is the currency that it's in? What is the future projection of inflation for that currency? What do you actually think it is currently? What is your actual return? That's something that should be contemplated because a lot of returns are nothing, no return. And you think that they're a return. I do want to touch on one other asset class that I haven't talked about. I've talked about real estate. I've talked about stocks. I've talked about bonds. I've talked about ETFs. I want to talk a combination here of commodity. I've talked a little bit about commodities. Now commodities, okay, I'll talk about commodities. I'll talk about cryptocurrencies. Basically, those are the two that I need to talk about here. Commodities are interesting and hard to learn about at the beginning a little bit because you have to understand what a future contract is, what options are a little bit, just a tiny little bit to understand commodity trading. Now you can invest basically in a company, so a stock that is highly correlated with a commodity. So if you buy Enbridge or you buy WCP, if you buy a oil related company that makes all of its profits from oil, then whatever oil's price is going to do will dictate basically the value of that stock. And you can do the same for gold. You can do the same for any commodity out there, silver, whatever. You could buy an actual company that is in some way is related to that asset. There's going to be input costs on their creation of that commodity. And that's going to also dictate. So there's a lot. It's not just as simple as a one-to-one. Now, the other way that you could get a little more direct exposure is by buying basically an ETF of futures contracts. So these are agreements to pay a certain amount for a certain commodity. And these are traded like stocks as well. This is beyond beginners here for sure. But the way that it can be brought into the beginner's scope is by just thinking of it as like ETFs and not having to be like understanding how to trade future contracts. You could buy UNG, for instance, is a ETF that basically tracks what natural gas is going for on the futures market. Now, futures, the history of that is it was created for farmers a long time ago to stabilize the value of their wheat and their corn and their soy. And it's become another way to gamble money in a lot of ways. And so that's something that I don't think an investor, a beginning investor, should really get too involved in, because they're not going to understand that investing environment enough to really get outsized returns doing it. It's going to be tough for a beginner. Now, you could definitely get into it, but that's going to be more intermediate, advanced stuff. And you could play around with it to have some fun, but a lot of time you're not going to know what you're doing until you learn. So I would avoid that a little bit. And you could do a little speculating, but just once again, that's gambling, right? Like that's gambling. Like, yeah, investing can be, there's a thin line between investing and gambling. And we are very susceptible as a species to gamble. So we just need to be careful about that. Talking about gambling, we're going into the most speculative environment, I would say. These are cryptocurrencies. Now, people talk about them like they're commodities. People talk about them like they're currencies. People talk about them like they're tech companies. Speculative, dot-com style tech companies of today. You could think about them in all those ways, and they would make some degree of sense. They're also their own unique thing. I think for a beginner, you should stay away from basically all cryptocurrency. Now, I do want to explain why I invest in cryptocurrency and why I think there's value in some of them. Now, I've talked about inflation. You know, if you're losing 3% of your value of your dollar every year, you could invest in assets that try to beat that or go up with and go up and match or benefit from inflation. Cryptocurrencies, some of them, Bitcoin specifically. Bitcoin to me is the most interesting cryptocurrency and the best cryptocurrency. It's the one I'm most heavily invested in as well, by far. Now, the biggest benefit to Bitcoin to me, and the reason people call it digital gold and all this shit, is that it's deflationary in nature. It has a fixed rate of inflation for a certain period of time, and then no new Bitcoin will get made. I think there's 21 million Bitcoin total or something like that. Don't quote me on the number. My memory is not good for that, but there's a certain amount every 4 years. So there's a certain amount of Bitcoin being released to the public constantly, and a lot of that is to people who have huge Bitcoin mining operations, and they sell that Bitcoin to the market pretty rapidly to actually to basically cover the expenses that they have and to use that as part of their way that they can operate, you know, pay their expenses. So Bitcoin is constantly being added to the market currently. And it's at a fixed rate. And every 4 years, that rate of Bitcoin that gets released to the public gets cut in half. Now, not every single person out there that mines Bitcoin is putting their Bitcoin on the market if they mine it anyway. Some people are holding that, and that actually decreases the supply in the market, which increases the price. So once again, it's just a simple market, supply and demand. And the way it's deflationary, so you could just think of that as being like, okay, Bitcoin has a fixed rate of inflation to a certain degree, and then eventually it will stop inflating. But how is it deflationary? Well, there's people that lose access to their Bitcoin. There's people that there's not a central service where you can phone up and say, hey, what's my password? Can I reset it? You can't go online and say, hey, what's my wallet address, passcode? Where is my Bitcoin? Like, give it back to me. You know, if you send somebody, you can't create a dispute and actually get that return to you. It's not PayPal. So what happens there is there are people who die without passing on their Bitcoin. There's people who forget how to access their Bitcoin. It's an unfortunate truth. There's Bitcoin that basically gets locked up and is unattainable by any means. So that's taking it out of supply, and in that way it becomes deflationary. So yeah, that's very interesting. And people think like, okay, there's this connection with gold and Bitcoin a lot. Now, gold basically has a fixed rate of inflation as well. Not a fixed rate. It has a rate of inflation. And that's what money was trying to emulate. It's trying to emulate a rate of inflation of around 2%. Now, gold, I think it's about 1.5% of the amount of gold kind of gets mined every single year and added to the supply of gold. There is some gold getting taken out of supply as well in electronics and not being recycled properly and things like that, but or getting lost or whatever, you know. It's not going back into the market. But overall, there's still a rate of inflation with gold. So that's something to consider if you think, okay, gold is a great store of value. It has been in the past, and I think it will be in the future for this, that, and the other reason. For me, there's a lot more utility to Bitcoin. There's a lot more, makes a lot more sense with the actual fixed rate of inflation, and the, I can actually see the deflation happening. So to me, Bitcoin makes a lot of sense there. And the utility of actually being able to transport it for way cheaper than you could gold. And yeah, so that's just my bull argument, for Bitcoin, and why I hold so much of it myself, is I think that I look at the future and I think this will be worth more. Speculation. And there's no balance sheet to look at. There's no PE ratio. That's price to earnings. That's another term that you might run into as a beginning investor. You have to evaluate different assets with different metrics. And some people have a hard time wrapping their heads around Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies at large and seeing their value. And the problem currently with cryptocurrencies at large is that they're built, a lot of them, in this way where you can't get the money back from somebody that you've sent it to. And what that is facilitates really easily is crime and scamming. So that's why I advise everyone to not get involved with cryptocurrencies, but to maybe look at Bitcoin, maybe Ethereum, but basically that's a company, so just know that. Bitcoin is completely decentralized, which there's a weird story actually. If you look into that, there's this guy or a group that created it, and we don't know who they are or whatever, and that person's gone. That person's not involved. And the system of Bitcoin operates completely decentralized. So there's computers all over the world running the network that is Bitcoin. And every single block that's built on top of it is being built by all of these different computers. So that makes it very secure. So for payment processing, which Bitcoin is a type of payment processing, you want something to be very secure. You want something to be basically unhackable, and you want proof of ownership, you know, that your money is yours or your asset is yours, and you want trust. And because there's no central organization, you don't have to trust PayPal. You don't have to trust MasterCard. So ownership and trust and decentralization, that's how Bitcoin works. That's why Bitcoin is valuable, because it solves those issues in such a fundamental way. But think of it as speculation, and think about allocating only a certain amount to that type of asset. That's something that people are commonly preach. Now, I wish I allocated a lot more in this downturn, because I saw the value of these things even at the distressed prices when other people did not. And I've made huge gains in my cryptocurrency. But because it's such a small percentage of my portfolio, and a lot of my portfolio is hedged for recession, my total gains haven't been as much as they would have been if it was all just cryptocurrency. So there is a bit of a trade, but you know, I might not have slept very well while a lot of my cryptocurrencies were down 30-40%. Now they're all up 30-40%, but that's the kind of the thing about different assets, is that they're going to have different volatility. They're going to have different highs and lows and kind of a different average. So if you cannot handle that 30% down, even just mentally, right? Or depending on your time horizon, then that isn't the right investment for you. If you have like less than a year of like ability to have something invested, something like fixed income, like bonds, GICs in savings accounts, that is the best option for you. If you have some more than a year, then you should start thinking about what are some other options for you. What is your risk tolerance? That's basically the main thing to contemplate. There's a lot there. I know I ended with this big cryptocurrency rant, but to me, inflation is one of the biggest problems that we face. It's one of these secret things that just eats away at the wealth. It basically steals all the wealth away from savers, from people doing the right thing. And it puts all the money into the class of people who own things. It puts more money in the pockets of people who own homes and assets and investments and people who have money. And I want to see a rebalancing of that. I don't think it needs to happen from some sort of communist ideology of a rework of the government. I don't think it needs to happen from the individual level of putting away more money and investing in assets. But I do think that maybe both of those things do have some value, and I don't know how it needs to happen, but we do need to take more control of inflation. We do need to fight inflation from a national level or an individual level, however we can. And we can fight it by understanding investing and understanding the time frames. Okay, so there's this other thing that I just want to, that I've touched on, that I just want to kind of finish my thought on, which is time in the market. You know, so like your investment horizon is very important, and you do lower the percentage of likelihood of losing money in the market the longer you have it in. You raise the percentage of having made money by being in the market. A lot of people talk about, like, there's this quote that's seriously, that is, time in the market beats timing the market. And it's just, the reason that is said is because it's incredibly hard to time the market, because on a daily level, the stocks move very, very small amounts compared to the weekly, the monthly. These percentages are way different, but it seems like a lot in the day-to-day. And as a species, as individuals, we lack patience. And it's also just very hard to predict the future. So there's a lot of... That's why it's very, very, very hard to time the market. But it is... in a sense, how you make, you know, kind of outstanding returns. It's how you make returns that are bigger than just normal returns. So it is very hard, but it is also, in a sense, I believe, very important to look at the price of things, to not just say, okay, I'm just going to do a giant lump sum of money into the S&P 500 because I know that I can hold it there for 10 years. Maybe you should look at some indicators, and this is where the term technical analysis goes in, which is basically, technical analysis is looking at charts and price action of an asset and using different indicators to see that it's overbought or oversold, or there's high volume or low volume, or historically it comes back to this kind of average, or you know, there's different ways to look at technical analysis. But I would recommend learning some technical analysis so that you can time your entry point to some degree. And you could maybe use one of those techniques like dollar cost averaging, or buying the dip, or dollar cost averaging, but increasing the amount when you think that there's a good buying opportunity, something like that, maybe a combination strategy. It's very hard to know if you're making the right choice. The more diversified and the longer term lowers your risk, and also just allocating the right amount of money so that you're not put in some, you know, that's the biggest thing, or not the biggest thing, but that's a big thing, is being a forced seller. You do not want to be a forced seller, because if you become a forced seller of an asset, you are thrown into the hands of the market at the time, and maybe you're down on that asset and you're becoming a forced seller and you're selling something at a time when it's not opportune time. So timing the market is important. That's the other thing that people struggle with, and a lot of people just buy kind of income oriented investments, you know, dividends or bonds or whatever, is because they cannot have the mental ability to check in, or they're not interested enough, or it's hard to learn when, but they cannot figure out a point to sell. There's a lot of market movement, and if you were able to just buy when it's low and sell when it's high each time, you would make a lot more than if you just bought at one point and sold even at the lowest point and the highest point, if you accurately did it. But that's very, very hard. Very, very hard, and I would say like impossible because of how complex everything is. But there is some degree that you can do that in. And I think it's finding your degree of ability to kind of enter the market, enter an asset at a time that suits you the best. So think about that a little bit, and think about everything that I've said a little bit. Think about if investing is right for you and what type of investing is right for you. And if you have any questions, let me know in the comment section below. This podcast is not going to become some sort of investing podcast. This is just something I'm interested in, and something that I have accumulated a lot of knowledge of that I can regurgitate into one podcast. And that's kind of what my hope was. I might come back to this if there's enough questions to answer, or I might just answer them in the comment section on YouTube. So thanks everyone for watching. The sun is in my eyes if you're watching this, so I'm ready to be done this. And once again, thanks everybody, and have a good day. Bye.